This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Fever by Mary Beth Keane. Read by Candace Thaxton.
Prologue, 1899. The day began with sour milk and got worse. You were too quick, Mary scolded herself when the milk was returned to the kitchen in its porcelain jug with a message from Mr. Kirkenbauer to take better care. He was tired, Mary knew, from the child crying all night and moaning and asking to be rocked. And he was worried. They'd tried to spare him. Mary, Mrs. Kirkenbauer, and the nanny had taken shifts with the boy, but the boy's room was just across the hall from his parents, and the boards of the new house creaked and whined, and the women sometimes forgot to keep their voices lowered. And finally, Mr. Kirkenbauer had emerged from the master bedroom in his nightshirt to ask what could be done. "Give him to me," he'd said to Mary at the start of her shift, just as the bleary-eyed nanny hurried back to her small room at the rear of the house. At 2 o'clock in the morning, none of them cared about being seen in their nightclothes. She'd handed the boy to his father. A baby, really. Still a baby. They called him a boy because he'd started calling himself a boy, but it wasn't true just yet. In 6 more months, perhaps, yes, but not yet. Not with those fat legs and cheeks, that unsteady, tottering step, the fact that he still loved a lap more than any chair. Mr. Kirkenbauer had observed in a whisper, "He's very warm." He put his pursed lips against the boy's forehead. Then he handed the child back to Mary and sat on the chair in the corner as she rocked the boy and told him all the wonderful things the morning would bring. "Did he want to see a sailboat?" Mary asked. "Did he want to throw rocks in the river? Did he want a warm bun straight from the oven?" But the child only stared and cried, and wrapped his hot arms around Mary's neck, tight, like they were at sea, and she his buoy, and he was terrified of losing his grip. Mary tried not to make too much of the milk being sent back, of the expression on the butler's face that was meant to mime Mr. Kirkenbauer's, and she reminded herself that Mr. Kirkenbauer was exhausted when he complained about the milk. They all were, and who knew what tone he'd really used when he gave the message to the butler, who had struck Mary from her first day as a nervous type. Mrs. Kirkenbauer was still upstairs, sleeping, or trying to, and the nanny was giving the boy a cool bath, his third in as many hours. A light rash had bloomed across his chest, and in the very early hours of the morning, Mrs. Kirkenbauer had suggested a plaster of bread and milk, or running to a neighbor for linseed oil. But Mary had said no. She'd seen the rash before. There was nothing for it but rest and trying to get the boy to eat something. The Kirkenbauers weren't the richest family Mary had ever worked for. Their kitchen was not as modern as most where Mary had cooked. But they were kind people. They paid her good wages, and other than a few specific requests from Mrs. Kirkenbauer, Mary had leave to do the shopping and serve whatever she liked. Sometimes after supper, Mrs. Kirkenbauer pitched in with the scrubbing, which Mary was baffled to discover she didn't mind. A mistress who hung around the kitchen with her hands in pots and pans and pantry would normally be intolerable, and if Mary had been told this was the way it was going to be, she never would have taken the job in the first place. But now that she was there and had gotten to know them, she was surprised to find that she didn't mind a bit. Mrs. Kirkenbauer had 3 sisters in Philadelphia and said she missed female company more than anything. Mary continually tried to take the temperature of her mistress's ease, so that perhaps, one day, she'd work up the nerve to ask her a question. Had she always been a person of means, or only when she married Mr. Kirkenbauer? The Kirkenbauers didn't know many people in Dobbs Ferry yet, which meant they seldom entertained, which meant Mary rarely had to cook for more than the 3 in the family and the staff and herself. The house looked at the Hudson, and on Sundays when the weather was fine, they had picnics on the river bank and always invited any among the servants who had not traveled home to their families for the day. Mary took the jug of milk the butler extended toward her. "Is it really gone?" she asked as she lifted it to her nose. "It's gone," she confirmed, clenching her teeth against the urge to vomit. She walked quickly to the narrow back door to throw it out. There was a faint sucking sound as the milk pulled away from the jug, and Mary watched it fly through the air as a solid thing until it landed, about 6 feet away, a white lump in the wet grass. In a few seconds, the foul smell filled up the space between the lump and the doorway where Mary was still standing. She fetched the kettle, just boiled, and hurried outside to stand over the wet lump with her head swiveled away as she poured the steaming water over it. She turned back just in time to watch it disappear in curdled rivers, get caught up in the green blades, soak into the ground. "Is that the end of it?" the butler asked, worried, casting his eyes toward the long hall that led back to the dining room. "There's more. There's plenty," Mary said. "That was only what I was saving for bread, but I forgot last night when I made the bread I used the buttermilk. I was too quick. The ice is low. I broke off big pieces to put in the child's bath, and what's left of the block needs more sawdust. They need a right icebox here is what they need. They need one of those zinc-lined jobs. I put the good milk in the back of the box, but this morning..." Mary thought she heard a footstep in the hall. She raised a finger to the butler to wait. "This morning," he said. They were alone. The recently cut timbers of the house creaked under the weight of the night's lashing rain, and now, even with every single window open and every door propped wide, the air was thick and hot. It settled on everything, and all morning the collar of Mary's dress had felt like a noose. "Nothing." It was no use explaining. Mr. Kirkenbauer was waiting in the dining room with his bowl of dry blueberries and his coffee still black. "Here," Mary said, putting a fresh jug onto the butler's salver. She'd have to make new bread for lunch to make up for the mistake, even though there was nearly a full loaf on the counter from yesterday. Even though that loaf would be fine with a little toasting, a pat of butter spread on top. "How's the child this morning?" the butler asked. His room was on the third floor, and thanks to that distance, he had gotten a full night's sleep. "No better, no worse, poor thing." The butler nodded. "About the milk, Mary. It's only to be expected in this heat. That's probably why the child feels feverish. I feel feverish myself." Not all butlers were so kind, but it seemed to work from one extreme to another in every house she had cooked for. Either the staff was a team that signaled one another with silences or a clandestine nod, or they were competitors, each one trying to smudge out the other's good work. Mary had been with the Kirkenbauers for only a month when the boy got sick, and later, when she looked back, she struggled to remember exactly what circumstances had brought her there, all the way up to Dobbs Ferry, when there were plenty of open positions in Manhattan. Alfred was still finding good work in 1899. He was still getting a clean shave every other day, earning Friday wages he handed over to Mary to pay a portion of their rent, their food. The agency had often wanted to send her to New Jersey, or Connecticut, or over to the western side of the Hudson where the trains didn't reach, but she always refused unless they were short-term jobs that paid too much to decline. And ultimately, those families usually went with a lesser cook, someone who couldn't get a job with a Manhattan family. But Mary could get a job with a Manhattan family, so why had she agreed to go up there to Dobbs Ferry, to a woman who was not a proper mistress but half-servant herself? The way she leaned into the pot to be scrubbed, the way she cast her eye around the kitchen for grease. Maybe it was because when she met Mrs. Kirkenbauer at the agency, there was something about the woman she liked. She didn't ask Mary if she was a Christian. She didn't ask if she was married or planning on getting married. She asked only about her cooking, and when the woman talked about food, about the responsibility of getting meals together every day of the week, she seemed to be speaking from experience. "Have you ever made sauerkraut, or do you always purchase it?" Mrs. Kirkenbauer had asked during their first meeting, and Mary admitted that she'd never done either, without adding that no employer she'd ever worked for had wanted sour cabbage and its sharp aroma anywhere near the floral patterns of their halls, the intricate moldings of their ceilings. If Alfred had an evening yearning for it, he went out to the streets in search of the roaming sauerkraut man and the steel drum he wore around the city. "Would you be willing to learn if I showed you once? Are you a quick learner?" How far removed is this woman from her native Philadelphia's version of the Lower East Side? Mary wondered, but simply answered, "Yes." Was that all it took to get Mary to agree to leave the city that summer? Had the wages been better than she remembered? No. Years later, when she had all the time in the world to think about it, every hour of the day, if she chose, every single minute, nothing seemed to add up. Least of all, seeing a younger version of herself step off a train to await pickup by Mr. Kirkenbauer himself because they had no full-time chauffeur. Alfred had begged her to decline the job. He'd wanted her to find something closer to home, promising a 4th of July fireworks show she'd never forget. He'd already begun stockpiling the rockets and sparklers and planned to invite everyone in their building to watch. But the 4th of July fell on a Tuesday that year, and Mary didn't want to organize her summer around one single day, so she left Alfred alone on 33rd Street to fend for himself. Maybe that was the spring when he told her once and for all that he'd never marry her. Not because he didn't love her, but because he didn't believe in it. In the old country, fine, some customs could not be shaken, but what was the point of America if two people couldn't do as they pleased? Funny how she grew so used to Alfred and the way they were that it was hard to believe there was ever a time when she wanted him to marry her, a time when she thought that he would, eventually when his mind came around to it, when he admitted to himself and to her it was the only right thing to do. It was even harder to believe that she'd ever considered their not being married their biggest problem. Maybe the summer of 1899 was when she finally admitted the possibility that the things he said were really the things he believed. There was no secret code to crack, no door she could knock upon to make him come around. She was not a woman who should have to convince a man to marry her. There were plenty who would trip over themselves for the chance. That was it, she remembered, a lifetime later, when she went over the details of that summer once again. That must have been it. Her pride was injured. She wanted to teach him a lesson. She wanted space from him to think, maybe to work up the courage to leave him, to try for a different kind of life. So she went away that summer and wished him the best for his fireworks show and told him she'd be home on Sundays or she wouldn't, depending on her mood. "And there's a child, isn't there?" the woman at the office had said during that first meeting, glancing at her notes. Mary noticed that Mrs. Kirkenbauer's clothes were exquisite, every stitch in its place, the fabric somehow skimming her slim figure and hiding it at the same time. She was younger than Mary, with a beautiful German face. "Yes, one, a boy. Is that a problem?" "Of course not," the agent had said. "Mary loves children, don't you, Mary?" "I do," Mary said in a flat voice. Mary did not love all children, but she did love that boy. Within 48 hours of her arrival in Dobbs Ferry, she saw that there would be no way to keep baby Tobias out of her kitchen, so she told his nanny to leave him, set him up on the floor with a toy, and let him watch. The clever boy played happily until his nanny was out of sight, and then he reached his hands up to Mary to be lifted so he could see for himself what she had on the stove. "Spoon," he said when he wanted a taste. "Hot," he warned when he saw steam coming up from a pot. She gave him a new word every day, and he stored it, trotting it out a few days later like he was born knowing it. It got so it was lonely in the kitchen without him. When he was there with her, she talked to him all afternoon. "You're a good boy," Mary would say, and he'd beat his chest and say, "Good boy." When she dressed in the mornings, long before anyone else in the house was up, she looked forward to the tug of his chubby hand on her skirt, his fat little leg sticking out beneath his short pants. She listened for him coming down the hall before breakfast, running as fast as he could manage toward her kitchen, to see her, to press his soft cheek against hers and say her name. And then came the morning when he didn't run to her, the morning when he walked, slowly, and when he got to the kitchen just sat in a corner and watched in silence, his plump cheeks rosy and hot when she touched them. When she lifted him, his body was slack, like he was already asleep, and when she carried him, he rested his head in the nook of her shoulder and abandoned himself to her, legs splayed across her hips, arms hanging at his sides. "Bread with jam?" she said to him, a test, the treat he loved most in the world. But he just looked at her, glassy-eyed, like he'd gotten older and wiser overnight and had moved beyond the excitement of bread and jam. As if the boy who loved bread and jam was another boy entirely, and this was a new boy, a more serious boy, a boy who knew as much as any adult. For a few minutes, as she swayed with him in the kitchen and listed all the things he loved to eat, she pretended to herself that she didn't know. "Tobias isn't feeling well," Mary told the nanny, and the nanny told Mrs. Kirkenbauer. The three women convened in the parlor where Tobias had fallen asleep on a pillow. "Too much sun yesterday," his mother said as she put her hand to his face. "And he had all that pie after dinner last night." "Should I ask the doctor to come?" "No," Mrs. Kirkenbauer said. "Sleep will cure him. He'll be better by supper. Leave him where he is." But he did not get better. He got worse. And after 4 days of the doctor coming by to tell them that there was nothing to be done except draw the cool bath and try to get him to eat. And on the same day as Mary served Mr. Kirkenbauer milk that had gone thick and sour overnight, Mrs. Kirkenbauer began to feel low. And then the nanny. And then the butler. And then the gardener, who came only twice a week, always taking lunch with them when he was there. After Tobias, they all seemed to get sick at the same time, in the same hour. And God forgive her, but she ignored the others until she got that baby into the tub. "Tub," he said, a whisper, when she put him in the water, keeping a hand under his arm so he wouldn't slip. She floated chunks of ice she'd hammered from the block and told him they were icebergs and he a sea captain, and it was his job to make sure the ship didn't run aground. He didn't object to the cold. He didn't demand a toy. He didn't ask for his mother. He didn't cry. After the bath, after his fingers had gone to raisins and she was afraid to leave him in there any longer, she wrapped him in a clean sheet and told him stories while he curled up in a ball like he was still a newborn, his knees tucked up to his chest. He looked more like a baby in the sheet, his curls damp, his cheeks so pink that a portrait of him at that moment might have made him look like a healthy child, the healthiest, like he'd just spent an hour running outside on a chilly winter's day. And then, on the seventh night of his illness, after a few hours of rocking, while the others called for her from distant rooms, his little body went limp, felt heavier in her arms. His head against her shoulder was a ton weight, his legs like anchors across her thighs. The hot flutter of his breath that had tickled her neck for the past several hours had disappeared. Mary rocked him faster, telling herself he'd be better after he'd had a good sleep for himself. He hadn't had a proper rest in a week, and now he was just having a sleep. Just sleep. A good, sound sleep. After a while, she laid him in his crib and went to tell Mr. Kirkenbauer, the only other member of the household who was not sick. "He's gone, sir," she said, and put her hand on his shoulder before she realized what she'd done. The doctor said Mrs. Kirkenbauer should not be told if she was to have any chance of recovery, and so Mary tried to keep the news from her face when she went in to nurse her. But 1 week later, Mrs. Kirkenbauer died as silently as her son, and the butler the day after that. The nanny and the gardener recovered. 2 weeks after the boy's death, after seeing to his little funeral suit, Mary packed her things and walked to the train station, leaving Mr. Kirkenbauer alone to decide what to do about all those dresses, that big, infected house, all those toy boats, the wooden horses, the collection of little shoes and caps. Maybe it was the timber, people said. Where had it been shipped from? Maybe it was the slope of the land and the way the water ran off down to the river. Maybe it was the pipe leading from the indoor privy. Maybe it was all the pickled herring and pig's knuckles Mrs. Kirkenbauer asked her cook to buy in town. Maybe the mistress didn't know how to run a house, being the daughter of a Philadelphia grocer and the granddaughter of a cabbage shaver. How lucky for her, the neighbors said, to have caught the eye of Alexander Kirkenbauer. How unlucky for him. People said the old country was full of death. Mary's old country and everyone else's. The American papers would have a person believe Europe was one large sick ward, the people dying in ditches, blown over by every stiff wind. Alfred's Germany was like her Ireland, from the sound of it, people fighting every minute to stay on the side of the living, killing one another over a bowl of rabbit stew, and praying every day that the roofs of their shelters would stay where they were. When babies were born, everyone willed them to live, but there was no surprise when they died, eventually, almost all of them, including the two Mary had cared for herself, bringing them 8, 9, 10 times a day to the teat of a neighbor's goat so they could suckle what Mary's sister couldn't offer, having died, bringing them to life, and what Mary couldn't offer, being only 14 at the time and having no babies of her own. The goat let them suck, but they died anyway. First the boy, and then the girl. And that's when Mary's Nana told her it was time for her to leave Ireland. To leave while she was able. In America, Nana said, people didn't die so easily. It was the air, she supposed. The meat. But people died in America, too, Mary learned quickly. It was just a sneakier death. A crueler death, in a way, because it always seemed to come by surprise. She didn't notice at first, but then she began to see it all around her. A meal pushed away for lack of appetite. A nap in the afternoon. A tired feeling that turned into a head cold. A rash into a ring of fire. A head cold into a fever that ravaged the person, left him beyond the reach of help. If they didn't die of illness, they died in fires. They were run over by streetcars, drowned in the river, suffocated after slipping into a coal hill and unable to scramble back to the surface. Neighbors, strangers on the street, peddlers at the market, children, priests, landlords, ladies. They all died, and every death was brutal. So what's a body to do? Mary thought as she stared out the train window at the Hudson and counted the minutes until she'd see Alfred again. But that warm, clever little boy this time. The more she instructed herself to think about other things, the more she thought of him, like lifting a black tarp to glimpse something horrible below. Glimpses were all she could manage. His face, that peculiar angled light in the Kirchenbauer kitchen, the dead weight of him. Recently, when she and Alfred were talking about marriage and managing to not raise their voices, he'd asked whether she wanted a child. If she wanted to have a child, then that was different. Then they'd have to be married for the child's sake. But I thought you didn't want that, Alfred pointed out, and she realized it was probably something she'd said. Not because she didn't think she'd love a child, or because she didn't think she'd be a good mother. She knew she'd love their child fiercely, entirely. She'd think about him or her every minute of her life, and that was the danger. They were so fragile, and it was so long until they grew strong. She thought of her sister's babies, curled against each other in their cradle, and then the girl alone. How at only 8 days old, she seemed to be searching for her brother. Her newborn fists closed so tight, Mary believed for a day she might live. She thought of Mr. Kirchenbauer, the day he picked her up from the train station. How he had no idea what was coming. "I'm sorry I left," she'd say to Alfred, who would be surprised to see her home so soon. But she wouldn't tell him what had happened, because how could she possibly explain to anyone about that boy, that baby? How could she begin? Thinking about him for a single second, the strong grip of his small hand, his belly, the happy swing of his leg on the chair when he bit into a piece of orange, any thought of him at all brought a roaring into her ears like she'd been plunged into the ocean with a weight tied around her foot. No. She decided. No. She'd go home and try to forget and do as she'd always done, which was work hard and be thankful every day for her good health, her life. Habeas Corpus. New York Daily Courant, March 24th, 1907. Cook accused of giving typhoid to New York's prominent families. So say authorities holding her prisoner. Sanitary engineer alleges she communicates the disease to others, although immune herself. Staff, New York. The cook for a prominent Upper East Side family has been forcibly removed from her employment and quarantined in Willard Parker Hospital after sanitary engineer and medical investigator George A. Soper alleged that she has been passing typhoid fever through her cooking, though she manifests no signs of the disease herself. At the time of her capture, she was cooking for one of the wealthiest families on Park Avenue. Dr. Soper further alleges that the daughter of the family was battling typhoid fever at the time the cook was apprehended and has since succumbed to the disease. Dr. Soper, the medical sleuth at the center of this case, put the pieces of this groundbreaking puzzle together after being called upon to investigate a typhoid outbreak that occurred in Oyster Bay last summer. He identified the cook as an asymptomatic carrier of typhoid fever, which, in layman's terms, is a healthy-seeming person who passes a disease along without suffering any symptoms of said disease, and most likely without any knowledge of doing so. Dr. Soper has spent several months making his case to the Department of Health, and one source reports that there are many within that organization who are skeptical about the notion of a healthy carrier, despite the evidence. It is Dr. Soper's belief that the woman poses a life-threatening risk to all of those who eat the food she cooks, and has been the cause of typhoid outbreaks in almost every prominent family she's worked for, going back at least 5 years, likely longer. The case of this human culture tube, as some would describe her, is attended to with more secrecy than any other this reporter has encountered in his career. It can only be assumed that authorities do not want to further embarrass those families who hired her and welcomed her into their homes. In response to a question on how rare this woman is to science, one doctor who asked to remain anonymous answered, "We just don't know." The woman is rumored to be of fair complexion, with a buxom figure and rosy cheeks. Whether she understands the charges piled against her is a matter of concern for the DOH. "We're talking about brand new science," a senior health inspector explained. "If what Dr. Soper posits is true, then she is the first healthy carrier of typhoid fever discovered in North America." The butler of the family, who was the cook's most recent employer, and who gave his name only as Francis, claims that the daughter's illness and death is nothing more than a tragic coincidence. He tells us that his own wife died of the illness several years back, and so have others he's known who never had any contact with the accused cook. He claims further that the cook was healthy and showed absolutely no sign of illness. "They took her like they would a common criminal," he said, showing visible signs of distress. "And for what? I don't believe what they've said about her." A female eyewitness to the cook's capture stated that she fought with the strength of 10 men, but they overpowered her. This incredulity, authorities say, is a matter of education, and further denials from the woman may lead to her permanent quarantine. A nurse at Willard Parker, who asked that her name be withheld, says the accused woman at the center of this case is the picture of fury. She refuses meals, declines company, and walks back and forth like a caged animal. When asked if she believes what's been alleged about the woman, the nurse replied, "I myself don't understand it, but I think the woman should try to listen to them. She's not helping herself the way she is now." Several leading doctors believe typhoid bacilli are manufactured in the gallbladder, and a representative from the Department of Health states that if the accused woman does not submit to surgical removal of her gallbladder within the month, she will be transferred to North Brother Island in the East River, where she will remain segregated from society for an indefinite length of time. When asked for his opinion of the case, Mr. Robert Abbott, a criminal attorney who practices in New York City, says that her situation strikes him as somewhat similar to that of Niall E. Joseph, whom Boston authorities have isolated upon suspicion of being a leper. 1. Mary wasn't arrested right away. There were warnings, requests. It all started with an air of courtesy, as if Dr. Soper believed that if he simply notified her of the danger lurking inside her body, she would excuse herself from society. And after, when he and his colleagues resorted to far less polite means, they said it was her fault for raising a knife instead of listening, for not doing as she was told. On a cold morning in March 1907, the Department of Health coordinated with the New York City Police Department and decided that Mary Mallon must be brought in. Dr. Soper suggested she might surrender more easily to a woman, and sent a doctor named Josephine Baker to ring the bell of the Bowen residence, where Mary was employed, with 4 police officers standing behind her. They had not considered that even in the face of such authority, her friends would lie for her, help hide her, insist that she could not be the person they were seeking. When they finally found her, she would not come peacefully, so each officer gripped her by a limb and carried her across the snow-covered yard while the rest of the domestic staff looked on. Once the police got her into the truck, she started swinging and kicking, until finally they wedged her between their stout bodies and held her as well as they could, and Dr. Baker sat on her lap. "Please, Miss Mallon," Dr. Baker said over and over, and after a while, "Please, Mary." Mary assumed they were bringing her to the police station on East 67th. So when the truck continued downtown in a southeasterly direction along the same route she took from the Bowens to the room she shared with Alfred on East 33rd, she thought for a hopeful moment they might be dropping her at home. They had come to teach her a lesson, she prayed, and now they would set her free. She glimpsed street signs through the small barred window as the driver turned east at 42nd Street. They traveled south along 3rd Avenue until 16th Street, and then east again with such urgency that she could feel the rhythm of the horses' sleek heads pumping. The truck stopped just before the river, at the main entrance of a building Mary didn't recognize, at the very end of a block, so desolate that she felt the first stirring of panic that no one she knew would ever find her there. Dr. Soper was waiting at the entrance to the Willard Parker Hospital, but instead of speaking to her, he just nodded to the pair of policemen who had braced her by her elbows. Up on the 6th floor, they hurried her along the corridor to the typhoid wing, where more doctors were waiting in a room with a gleaming mahogany table. One of her guards indicated where she should sit, and before she could properly look around the room, Dr. Soper told her, and the rest of the people present, that the newest theory of disease had to do with germs and bacteria, and although Mary appeared perfectly healthy, he had good reason to believe that she was, at that very moment, manufacturing typhoid bacilli inside her body and passing along the disease to innocent victims. He accused her of making 23 people sick and being the cause of at least 3 deaths. "Those are the cases we know of," he said. "Who knows how many more we'll find when we can investigate Miss Mallon's full employment history?" In front of 5 other men and Dr. Baker, Dr. Soper turned to her, finally, the source of all this trouble, as if waiting for her to say something. Mary felt like her mind had dropped straight out of her head like a stone. "George," Dr. Baker said, "she hasn't even been here 15 minutes. Perhaps we could give her time to collect herself."
"Back here in half an hour, then?" one of the doctors asked.
"In the morning, gentlemen," said Dr. Baker. "There is nothing that can't wait until morning, is there?" "No," Mary thought. "This mistake will be corrected by morning, and I'll be gone. I'll walk straight home, make a pot of coffee, tell the whole story to Alfred, and never come near the Willard Parker Hospital again." Dr. Soper tilted his head and considered Mary from across the table.
"Tomorrow," he agreed. "Fine."
Mary's bed was at the end of a row, in a large room that held 16 beds, all occupied except for hers, which waited, with the sheets tucked tight and the small, flat pillow placed exactly at the center of the head. Guards stood outside the entrance of the room, positioned so they could see her through the narrow pane of glass on the door. A nurse had left her alone for a moment shortly after showing her to her room, and she'd simply opened the door and walked toward the stairs, but an officer shouted at her to stop, and a passing doctor blocked her way. "I was told I could get word to someone," she said to the officer as he marched her back. "When?" But he only shrugged, rocking back and forth from heel to toe as he eyed her, and she felt a twitch go through her body as she measured the distance to the end of the corridor. That first night at Willard Parker, when a nurse came in to turn off the lamps, Mary lay on her cot and pressed her hands against her ears. It was a misunderstanding, surely. Everything would be sorted out in a matter of days. Alfred wouldn't expect her home until Saturday, and would have no way of knowing what had happened. Even then, he might not worry, believing she'd been asked by the Bowens to stay on through the weekend. She had only the money in her pocket and the clothes on her back. Dr. Baker had said she'd be allowed a telephone call, but who would she call? There was no telephone in the room she shared with Alfred. No one in their building had a telephone. She certainly couldn't call the Bowens. Lying on her side and facing the wall, Mary pressed her palms harder against her ears, but could still hear her roommates retching, sobbing, calling for people, relatives probably, loved ones already dead. She'd seen it all before, but not like this. Not so many in a single room. 15 nightmares twisted together, plus hers, the 16th, the strand that didn't look like any of the others. Finally, she gave up on sleep and went over to the window, which looked west along 16th Street. The sidewalk was dark except for the yellow glow of a single street lamp, and she searched the darkness for another 6th-floor window and the shape of Alfred standing at it, not even 20 blocks away. If I shout, she thought, how far away will I be heard? She tried to imagine what he was doing at that hour. He never slept well when she was not at home. The occupant of the bed nearest the window moaned, and Mary looked down to find a girl, no more than 13, her long, dark hair wet with sweat and stuck in tendrils around her neck. Mary gathered it together and smoothed it away from the girl's face. She turned her pillow to the cool underside. She told her it would all be over soon, and it would, for better or for worse, and fetched her a cup of water. She did the same for the rest of them, and one woman clutched Mary's wrist, called her Anna, and begged her not to leave. "We'll be home soon, Anna," the sick woman assured Mary, and Mary agreed that they would. By dawn, there were new guards stationed outside her door, and she was back in her own bed, observing the practiced approach of the nurses as they advanced on each patient with a bucket of cold water and a stack of clean washcloths pulled behind them on a wheeled cart. Mary forgot her predicament for a few moments as she saw how the abrupt coolness of a damp cloth at the head and neck made each woman still for a moment, as if listening for something. A cloth under each arm calmed the features of their face, brought them hope, and at the groin brought relief to their whole bodies, and in some patients, tears. When the nurse who was tending to Mary's row arrived at her bed, she held up a cloth and looked at her. "You've no fever," she said. "No." "I'm supposed to do the compress to everyone. They didn't say yay or nay about you." "I'll tell them you did it." "Fine," the nurse continued to observe her. "When did you have it?"
"Never."
"But you're passing it along? People catching it from you?"
"Is that what they said to you?"
"I said it to all the doctors and nursing staff."
"It's a lie."
The nurse tilted her head and looked at Mary's body from her face down to the lump under the sheet that was her feet and back up to her face. "Well, do you want the cloth anyway? And the water? To wash yourself. I gather you've had an ordeal."
"Yes,"
Mary sat up in the cot. "Yes, thank you." The nurses repeated the routine every hour, skipping Mary after that first time. At mid-morning, Soper came and perched himself on the arm of a chair that was wedged between Mary's cot and the wall. He told her it was time for her to cooperate, that they had a great deal of work ahead of them. As he spoke, his eyes kept glancing over to the nurses as they moved about the room, lifting sheets, moving knees apart. He jumped up and asked to see Mary in the hall. "How long do you mean to keep me here?" Mary asked, refusing to move until he gave her an answer. "Come out to the hallway, Miss Mallon," he said. "No," Mary said, lying back on her pillow and pulling the sheet to her chin. "I don't want to have to ask for this man's assistance," he said, gesturing toward one of the guards. "One way or another, I must talk to you about your gallbladder."
"One way or another, I must get word to my friends to let them know what's happened to me."
"Later, Miss Mallon. Very soon." The first time Mary had encountered Dr. Soper was in the Bowens' kitchen, almost 1 month earlier. She mistook him for a guest who'd arrived too early. It was a bitter cold day, and there were fires going in every room except for the servants' quarters, where the small stove would stay cold until bedtime. The Bowens had the type of home where it was easy to lose oneself, large in some senses, tall and broad with great rooms, the distant ceilings covered with paintings of different scenes from foreign places, and windows looking out onto Park Avenue. But the natural light disappeared as one retreated farther into the house, and at the rear of the residence, the staff had to work by lamplight all the time. Mary had looked up from her work, a beautiful pair of ducks whose skin she was pricking with a knife so that the fat would drain out when she roasted them, and saw a tall man clutching his hat to his chest. He had a light step, and she didn't hear him until he was nearly on top of her. He was handsome, in that way some men in New York are handsome, neat as a pin, his clothes pressed, his hair and mustache precise. He was not a man who had ever shoveled coal or hauled ice or butchered an animal. He was not a man who owned a pair of work boots. He seemed older, though she later learned that they were the very same age, their birthdays 1 week apart. Toward the end of her second day at Willard Parker, she answered a few of his questions and hoped that meant he would release her. But Just after breakfast on her third morning, he summoned her back to the room with the mahogany table and invited five other doctors to ask her questions as well. She recognized three of them from the day of her arrival. Dr. Baker was not present. Led by Dr. Soper, they kept asking if she was absolutely certain that she'd never had typhoid fever, if she could recall for them every person she'd known who'd suffered a fever since her arrival in the United States 24 years before. "Every person I've known who ever had a fever? Since 1883? Mary almost laughed. Would they be able to do it if they were asked the same thing? "Or in Ireland," one of the doctors said. "Any person who had a fever as far back as you can remember." Their records on her went back to only 1901, and Mary decided they knew enough about her life in those 5.5 years. She would not give them more. "I can't remember," she said. Dr. Soper walked over to her chair and asked her to demonstrate how she washed her hands after visiting the laboratory. Feeling so many eyes studying her and knowing they would just keep asking if she refused, she made a peaceful scene in her mind and walked to the sink at the back of the room, with her pulse thumping in her ears. They stood closely behind her to observe, so she went slowly, rubbing the bar of soap on the backs of her hands as well as her palms, between her fingers, taking the kind of time she never did when she had to worry about getting supper on the table at an appointed hour. She dried her hands on the hand towel hanging next to the sink, and they observed this as well. "What are we missing?" Dr. Soper wondered aloud once they'd all returned to their seats. Missing from his notes were the details, Mary knew. The small things a woman notices. The expression on a person's face when he turns away and thinks himself unobserved. When Dr. Soper appeared in the Bowens' kitchen that night, she'd reached up to move a length of hair that had fallen out of her bun. She'd lifted her apron to wipe the duck fat from her hands. She'd closed her fist around her pricking knife and asked if she could assist him. He had blue eyes. His face was longish and white. His cheeks shaved so close that his face looked as smooth as her own, except for the mustache. His lips were parted in excitement. His eyes were glazed over, and once they locked on her, they didn't move. Just drank her in, every inch of her. He looked directly at her face, at her mouth, at her body, like he owned her, like there was no one in the world who knew her body better than he did. The knife was greasy, and she couldn't find a sure grip. "Shall I call for Mr. Bowen?" she inquired. "Shall I have someone show you back to the drawing room?" Hadn't there been, just a few days earlier, an article about a Greek who'd attacked a schoolteacher inside her own home, raped her, left her to die? Bet, the laundress, had disappeared outside to the narrow breezeway at the side of the house. Missing from Soper's notes was the feeling in her belly when she looked up to find a stranger striding into her kitchen, to hear him demand to know if she was Mary Mallon. How disorienting it was to have a man like him, with his perfectly tailored jacket, his ivory-white fingernails, his polished shoes extending from the bottom of his pants, the cuffs immaculate as if he floated above the mud and shit that made up the streets of New York City, and never walked through it like the rest of them, use her full name and know that he was not lost, that she was the one he was looking for. He'd finally come to a stop between Mary and the stove. She could make out perspiration on his sideburns. He had high, sharp cheekbones, and his face was flushed. "A creditor," she decided. "What's it to you?" Mary asked. Soper stepped closer. She could smell tobacco on his skin. She tightened her grip on the knife. "My name is George Soper. I'm a sanitary engineer and have been hired by Mr. Thompson to investigate the typhoid outbreak that occurred at his home in Oyster Bay this past summer. I've reason to believe you are the cause, not only of that outbreak, but of several outbreaks in and around New York City. You must come with me immediately, Miss Mallon. You must be tested. Can you confirm that you were employed by the Warren family last summer and that you worked for them for 6 weeks at the home they rented from Mr. Thompson in Oyster Bay?" Mary couldn't remember her first response, only her wonder at what that had to do with anything. "Pardon?" "You're sick, Miss Mallon. You must be tested." "I'm sick?" Mary forced a laugh. "I've never felt better." "You are carrying sickness. I believe you are a typhoid fever carrier." She felt dumb and slow, like she'd been turned around and then been asked to walk a straight line. She leaned her hips against the counter to steady herself. "Leave now, please," she said.
I don't know what you're talking about. You don't understand, Miss Mallon. It's imperative that you come with me now for testing. I've alerted the lab at Willard Parker Hospital to be ready for your arrival. You must cease cooking immediately. He went to take her by the arm, but she held out the knife and the roasting fork together and made a swipe in his general direction. Get out, she hissed. Mrs. Bowen hadn't been feeling well all day, but was upstairs being dressed. Mr. Bowen was hard of hearing. Someone had let Soper into the house, surely. Someone knew he was down in the kitchen, yet no one seemed to be coming. She went for him again with the fork in the lead. Soper stepped backward into the hall. You must listen, Miss Mallon.
I have a mind to stab you with this fork, so you'd better get out of my kitchen.
It's not your kitchen, Miss Mallon.
Mary made another move for him, and he took several steps back. He stumbled for a moment, his knuckles white where he gripped his hat's brim. He looked at her as if he had more to say, but then retreated quickly down the hall. A few minutes after Soper left the kitchen, Frank, the butler, appeared.
Where were you? Mary asked.
Mr. Bowen was giving me instructions. Who was that? He's just standing on the sidewalk, looking at the house. I think he has a mind to come back in.
He had some cock and bull story he'll tell them, Mary said, laying down the knife and fork.
She began to pace. They heard the sound of the doorbell.
Leave it to me, Frank said after a moment.
Mary crouched in the hall as Frank opened the door.
They're not available at the moment, Frank said when Soper asked for Mr. or Mrs. Bowen. Would you like to leave a message?
I could wait.
I'm afraid not. A dinner party, you see.
A message, then, Soper grumbled as he searched his breast pocket for a note card and pen. He scribbled as much as he could fit onto the small space.
Make sure you give this to them, Soper said, looking the older man in the eye.
Frank gave an abbreviated bow, took the note from Soper, and wished him a good night. When he had closed the door on the doctor, he walked the message to the fire and threw it in. Thank you, Mary said. They watched the paper vanish until Mrs. Bowen's bracelets jangled a warning from the top of the stairs.
Soper's appearance in the Bowen kitchen was Mary's first warning, but it had come coded, and Mary couldn't decipher it. By the time she was sure Soper had left for good and the ducks were roasted and sliced, she decided it was a misunderstanding and wondered at herself for not saying more. Why had she not told him that she'd never had the fever? And that she was the one who'd nursed the Warrens back to health? Why had she not told him to check his facts, that the local doctor in Oyster Bay had already concluded that they'd gotten the fever from soft-shell crabs? Mary liked working for the Bowens, but if that man called again and told them his story, or if he sent them a letter by the post and they believed him and fired her, she'd go back to the office and have them place her somewhere else. If he told that agency, she'd use another agency. If he told all the agencies, she'd go over to New Jersey where they didn't like to pay fees. After a week at Willard Parker, Dr. Baker finally came to check on her.
"Where were you?" asked Mary. "You said I could get word to someone."
"And you haven't?"
"I keep telling them, but it's been a week."
"I'm sorry, Mary," Dr. Baker said, and Mary's frustration wavered at hearing her first name. The other doctors called her Miss Mallon. "I work at a lab uptown and can't get down here as often as I'd like." She removed a few lined pieces of paper from the thin stack on her clipboard.
"You can..."
"Yes," Mary said, too grateful to be insulted. "Yes, of course." Dr. Baker also handed over an envelope.
"There should be a pen at the nurse's station. I'll tell them you're permitted to use it. When you finish, give it back to them and they'll post the letter for you."
"Thank you," Mary said, and placed paper and envelope on her bedside table. Now that she had a means of getting in touch with Alfred, Mary wanted to consider what she'd say, how exactly to describe what had happened. They'd argued the last time they'd seen each other, but none of that mattered now. And there were practical concerns, too. Her friend Fran had asked her to make a birthday cake for her daughter, and it was starting to seem like Mary would not be freed in time. She had planned to shape the cake like a daisy, with yellow and white buttercream frostings. The child would be disappointed.
"Will you walk with me?" Dr. Baker asked.
They strolled along the corridor, with the guard trailing just behind.
"Mary," Dr. Baker said finally, "they've asked me to talk to you about surgery, about removing your gallbladder. I know Dr. Soper has already explained it, but perhaps there are questions he hasn't answered."
In the week since Mary had last seen Dr. Baker, there were several doctors, in addition to Dr. Soper, who tried to convince her to let them remove her gallbladder. Just that morning, Mary had been called to a meeting with three doctors at once. "We'll get the best man to do the cutting," said a doctor named Wilson. And Mary asked the three men present if they'd agree to be sliced open as well, since there was nothing in the world wrong with them either. What would New York come to if surgeons went around cutting open all the healthy people just to take a look at what was inside? They explained it to her over and over, as if she didn't know what it was to cut a body from neck to navel. But she was a cook, for God's sake. She once butchered a Jersey heifer with only one other person to help, and when she was finished, even after draining the cow well before cutting, she was bloodied to her shoulders, and all those wet and glistening parts that made up the cow, when they were laid out on her table, would never have fit back inside that animal the way God made her, had Mary decided to change her mind, put her back together, stitch her up like new. All the worse that they planned to slice her alive. "I won't let them open me. I've told them already. You can tell them, too." Dr. Baker regarded her in silence for a moment and then nodded. "They'll send you to North Brother Island. They'll put you in quarantine." "They can't. I'm not sick. I didn't do anything wrong," Mary thought of the paper and envelope waiting for her by her bed. No matter how Alfred was feeling, no matter what kind of week he was having, he'd hear the beating heart at the center of her message, and he'd leave whatever he was doing to find her and help her figure a way out of this trouble. Once, about 5 years earlier, when she was miserable at a job in Riverdale, he'd shown up in her employer's kitchen one morning to see for himself how low she was. And when she told him everything that she'd promised herself she would not tell him, that the missus had slapped a tutor and threatened to slap Mary, that the man of the house found reasons to brush up against her, Alfred did not make a scene, did not raise his voice. He only listened. And when she was finished, he told her the decision was entirely up to her. He'd only come to see her face, but if he had half her talent for cooking, he'd walk out of that horrible house and find something else. "Come home with me right now," he said. And even as she protested that she'd already mixed the batter for muffins, had already sunk a turkey breast in a bucket of brine, she felt a shiver of recklessness and knew she wanted to do exactly that. Alfred put his hands on her waist and made her look at him. "Leave it," he said. So she left the batter to harden on the counter and walked with him to the train station. Along the way, he sang a German folk song and danced along the sidewalk to make her laugh. Miraculously, the family never told the agency, or else the message got lost, because the same agency placed her in a new situation the very next week. She imagined Alfred storming through the main entrance of Willard Parker. If they block him at the front door, she thought, he'll come through the back. If they lock the back door, he'll build a tunnel. He'll scale the walls. He'll drop in from the sky to fend them off so that I can get home. Alfred, she thought, willing him to hear her. It was something she used to do when she began getting more jobs that took her out of town and away from him. She'd take her break on a quiet back porch and think hard on his name. She'd crawl into bed at night and extinguish every other thing in her mind except for him. Later, when she was back home, she'd tell him what she'd done, and he'd sit up taller and ask which days exactly, what times, because there was one afternoon when he was walking through the park and had a feeling she was there, trying to tell him something. "They can, Mary, and once you're on North Brother, it will be more difficult to..." "To what?" "To get back." "Miss Mallon," a nurse called from behind them, "it's time to give another sample." "I'll be back in a few days," Dr. Baker said, placing her hand lightly on Mary's arm. "Wait," Mary said, and heard the panic in her own voice. "Don't forget to tell the nurses about the pen, about posting my letter." "I won't forget." When Mary got back to her room, the paper and envelope were gone. She opened the small drawer next to her bed. She dropped to her knees and searched the floor. She checked under the pillow, inside the pillowcase, under the top sheet, down by the steel casters in case they'd been carried in a draft. "Did anyone take the paper and envelope that were left here for me?" she asked, looking from cot to decide which among them was healthiest, which among them would have the nerve. "They were mine, and I'd like them back immediately." Her voice was the loudest sound the women had heard since arriving at the hospital, and some of them, who had not stirred in days, turned to look at her. "One of the doctors," the girl by the window said. He came in and put them on his clipboard when he saw you weren't here.
Which?
Him, the girl said, pointing.
Miss Mallon?
Dr. Soper's voice came from behind her, and when she turned, he was backlit by the lamps of the corridor.
Did Dr. Baker speak to you about surgery?
Can I have my paper back?
Not until we've talked about surgery.
My God, she thought, pressing her fingertips to her temples. Didn't these people know when a subject was closed? Had she not made her position clear? Or did they mean to drive her insane with the same questions over and over and over? Everything in the room seemed to slide to the left. She walked quickly to the window and pushed it up. She had a birthday cake to make. She had a man who had no idea where she was. She had to find a new job. There was a quartet playing at Our Lady of the Scapular in 2 weeks' time, and her friend Joan had offered to make her a dress. The cold pushing in through the open window was a salve on her hot skin, and she could hear someone whistle for a taxi. The music of a banjo floated through the air from some point north of the hospital. Passing under the light cast by a single street lamp were a few feathery flakes of snow. Dr. Baker said,
Dr. Baker isn't in charge here. She shouldn't have made promises.
Mary felt his words like a fist to her gut. She leaned out the window as far as she could. Hello, she cried at the street below. She waved her arm so someone might see her. She shouted again, but her voice was choked, and Dr. Soper had his arm around her waist. Help me, she said to the other women as Soper and the guards dragged her across the room, into the hall, and then pushed her ahead of them to a private room farther down the corridor, where Dr. Soper continued to brace her from behind, and a nurse struggled to open a small vial and pass it under Mary's nose.
I don't know why you always insist on making a scene, Miss Mallon, Soper muttered in her ear as they struggled. She could feel his breath on her neck, the sharp point of his chin where it pushed into her scalp.
Relax, the nurse whispered. Just relax.
2. Just as Dr. Baker had warned, after 2 weeks of testing at the Willard Parker Hospital, Dr. Soper told Mary that since she would not agree to have her gallbladder removed, the Department of Health had no choice but to transfer her to North Brother Island. There were facilities on the island where researchers could continue testing in a calmer, more focused atmosphere. She could notify her friends and family when she arrived on the island, but not before. Soper watched her every chance he got, and when he turned away, Mary felt space to breathe for a moment, until he turned back. She would not beg. They had enough power over her already. Soper had forbidden anyone at Willard Parker to give her a means to contact her friends. No more promises to post messages, and Mary clung to her composure by reminding herself that Alfred must have seen the newspaper articles. A night nurse had shown Mary the article that was in the Sun, and said there were others. Her capture was mentioned in almost every major paper. The papers didn't have her real name. They referred to her only as the Germ Woman, but Alfred would figure it out. It was possible, she thought, that he'd already tried to come to her, that he'd shown up at the hospital, demanding to see her, but had been turned away.
Isn't that a consumption island? Mary asked.
Riverside is a tuberculosis hospital, yes, but they've seen typhoid too, diphtheria, measles, everything.
Mary shivered. How long? She asked.
A few weeks, Dr. Soper said.
Mary told herself that she could put up with anything for a few weeks. She'd let them test her, and when they got whatever it was they needed from her, the ordeal would be over, and she'd never have to see Soper again. From the first hour of her arrival, North Brother Island seemed to Mary too flimsy for the roiling East River. It was as if a jagged corner of Manhattan had broken off and floated away before getting caught in the prehistoric rock that lurked just below the surface of the water. North Brother was a little skip of land, an oversized raft made of dirt and grass where the dying went to wait their turn. It was located just above Hellgate, that point in the East River where half a dozen minor streams met head-on before rushing out to sea, and only a fool would dip her toe in the water there. The entirety of North Brother would barely be big enough for a respectable estate if it were anywhere but New York. But in New York, or at least in Manhattan, where even the very rich live within arm's length of their neighbors, it was a rarity. A stretch of space that was quiet and private, and where everyone there was meant to be there. adult men and women whose names appeared on the roster of approved persons, the ferryman, kept under the bench seat of his small vessel, protected from the spray. There were no automobiles on North Brother, only a single horse, and that one, old and mangy, retired from pulling a sanitation cart and donated to science. During the day, there were always a few bicycles leaning against the western gable of the hospital, the side closest to the ferry that carried the nurses and doctors back and forth from 138th Street in the Bronx. But no one ever used those bicycles to pedal around the island, and seeing them there, leaning haphazardly against the red brick wall or lying on their sides on the grass, Mary needed no further proof that she'd been removed from the city. If she were in the city, in the real city, and not this in-between place, those bicycles would be gone inside an hour, liberated from their spots and cycled away by Lower East Side teenagers. There were few urban sounds on North Brother. No store shutters creaking open in the morning, clanging closed at night. No bells, no rumble of the L overhead, no peddlers hawking their wares, no children hopping balls, no old women shouting from upper-story windows. In their place were the sounds of tree frogs, birds, the gardener's clippers slicing the hedges into neat squares, and everywhere, always, the sound of water lapping the shore. Everything, everyone, stayed put, at least until evening came, when the doctors hustled out to the pier to make the awkward step down into the ferry, and the night shift leaned into the slight incline of the walking path and through the hospital's wide front door. The evening croak of a heron on the island's eastern shore sounded to Mary like a taunt, and chilled her. 16 buildings anchored North Brother, ranging in size from the main building of Riverside Hospital to the gardener's tool shed. There was also the morgue, the chapel, the physical plant, the coal house, the doctor's cottages, the nurses' residences, the x-ray building, the greenhouse, and so on. The circumference of the entire island could be walked in less than 3/4 of an hour, and from any point on North Brother, unless there was a building or a tree blocking the view, one could look back and see Upper Manhattan, and, north of that, the invisible seam where Manhattan met the Bronx. When it rained, the current that charged over the pebbles and jagged stones of shore reminded Mary of a pack of galloping horses steaming towards the sea. There were no typhoid patients at Riverside on the day she arrived, so they assigned her a bed in the main tuberculosis ward. A nurse provided her with paper and envelopes, a pen with a reservoir of ink. She wrote to Alfred what, by then, surely he already knew. But unlike the letter she drafted in her mind when she was still at Willard Parker, the first letter from North Brother was matter of fact. No patient at Riverside Hospital was permitted to have visitors, so she counseled patients, told him it might help to pretend she'd gotten a situation too far away for her to visit. Maine, perhaps, or Massachusetts. And before he knew it, she'd be home. She was angry, but had learned that anger wouldn't get her far. "So I may not see you until Memorial Day," she wrote. Worst-case scenario, she thought. 2 whole months should be plenty of time. He'd had a difficult stretch over the winter, not working, spending far too much time at Nation's Pub, but she decided not to mention any of that. "Remember the rent, if you haven't already." After listening to the hollow coughs from her fellow patients for a few days, Mary learned to predict the end. When a rattle in the chest sounded like a penny thrown into a very deep well that had gone dry. She observed that the consumptives looked like relatives, the same pall, the same dark rings under the eyes. They would stare at Mary and wonder what she was doing there. At night, she slept with a sheet over her face in case she might breathe in their disease, but after a week, she stopped worrying. During the day, she couldn't stop herself from flaunting her health, walking back and forth by the windows, asking the nurses if she could be of assistance. On sunny afternoons, she took a book from the hospital library and read in the courtyard. On less temperate days, she jotted down ideas for recipes so as not to lose her sense of purpose. She made sure to get outside every day, even if it was just for a few minutes, and when she got back to her cot and nodded to her neighbors, she felt the pink glow in her cheeks, the rise and fall of her chest, the power in her lungs. The confusion on their faces confirmed what she already knew. A mistake. A terrible error had been made, but would soon be corrected. She submitted to their tests without protest, and hoped that the sooner they collected all the information they needed, the faster they would let her go. She had not seen Dr. Soper since the first day she arrived on North Brother, And when she asked about it, Dr. Albertson told her that she likely wouldn't be seeing much of Dr. Soper anymore. He might check in on her now and again, and of course her test results would be shared with him, but his part in her case was likely over. This tiny piece of good news lifted her spirits for a day. The doctors on North Brother seemed even more greedy than those at Willard Parker to look at her body. They wanted her hands, her belly, her breasts, her hips. They wanted every wet thing that came out of her, top to bottom. But when they came to her face, their eyes flicked away. Some of her interrogators weren't doctors who had patients, but different types of medical men, like Soper, who called himself an engineer but seemed to know diseases. Some of them only studied things and took notes. The questions had changed since Willard Parker. There, they wanted to know about every fever she'd ever had. Had she ever had a rash on her bosom? Now they demanded to know when she knew. "You're an intelligent woman," they said. "Several of your employers said you read novels when you had time off. You must have known. How can you ask us to believe you didn't know?" Mary tried to think of images that would block out the questions, any memory at all that would take her away from North Brother. But more often than not, thinking of Alfred and her friends made her less patient with their questions, more frantic to get home.